Guess who's coming to town? It's me. I will be speaking at the National Restaurant Association Trade Show this month in Chicago. In addition to the keynote, I'll be offering complimentary one-on-one coaching sessions at the Yelp for Restaurants booth the day of the presentation. Be sure to stop by booth number 6064 to say hello and sign up for a strategy session. And if you can't make it, check out the Yelp for Restaurants website for a ton of free tools and templates to help you level up your restaurant today. Visit restaurants.yelp.com/full comp to learn more. Now here we go.
I still feel it's very important for me to be involved day to day with the team in the kitchen and make sure that they see that I'm there, that I care about what we're doing, that I'm going to contribute to making their day as pleasant and as easy as I can.
Welcome to Full Comp, a show offering insight into the hospitality industry, featuring restaurateurs, thought leaders, and innovators. Served up on the house. Are you on track to hit your profitability goals for this year? If you're struggling to hit your numbers, I might be able to help. Here's how I do it. Every year, I offer 5 complimentary growth sessions to restaurant owners looking to scale. In this call, we'll examine your current situation to see what is and isn't working. We'll identify your growth possibilities by the close of the year. We'll uncover the number one thing holding you and your business back. And we'll develop a growth plan that will get your business results. Go to planwithjosh.com to schedule one of the 5 complimentary growth sessions. They're going to go quickly. They always do. Chef Andrew Zimmerman has been a fixture in Chicago's fine dining scene for almost 2 decades now. In his quiet pursuit of excellence, he's collected a lifetime's worth of Michelin stars, forgetting the dozens of other accolades. We sat down today to discuss what has set him apart from his competitive set and the strategies he's used to be as relevant today as he was when Michelin first came to town.
I had been playing in bands and pursuing music from like the middle of high school. And I went to college as a saxophone major, which is a preposterous kind of major, really. Like the earning potential of your average saxophone major is probably pretty low, if we're honest. But I thought, you know, I'll go as a music major, but my aspirations are still to be in a successful rock band and do rock records and make money that way. And I knew that that was a pretty long shot thing, but I was also looking at it like I didn't expect to be in the Rolling Stones. I was just hoping I could do it in a kind of early 90s indie way enough so that I could make enough of a living that I'd be cool with it. And I liked the notion of somewhat limited amounts of responsibility, lots of travel, and doing something that was creatively focused and didn't have a real 9-to-5, or there was no real clock. To fund that pursuit, I worked in restaurants. And some of that was just started out as happenstance, where a friend of mine got me a dishwashing job when I was like 15 years old. And after, you know, did that for a while, and I moved up to do the salads and the raw bar stuff. And it was still relatively easy. At the time, I didn't take it very seriously because I thought, well, I'm not really doing this. This is just a way to make some money. It's a summer job or whatever. But then one job turned into another job and turned into another job, because now I was in the industry and it was easier than and more appealing than, say, mowing lawns for a summer or any of the other kinds of summer jobs that kids get. But that kept going on and on. And then in my sort of like late 20s, and my band is not going anywhere really, and I'm not really supporting myself playing music in any way, and I'm looking at like, well, what am I going to do? At the same time that all that was happening, I've always really had an interest in food and in cooking. And I've always really liked to eat good food. And I always felt like, well, I could just learn how to make good food, at least even for myself. And over time, what ended up happening was like my jobs that were giving me money and my interest in food started to intersect a little bit more aggressively. And I started to realize, well, when you cook, people tell you it's good and they pay you. When your band plays, they barely pay you and not that many people show up. Maybe you're better at cooking. Maybe consider that this is something you're actually better at, that you like doing and you're interested in. And that was kind of how the decision was made. And also, things happened around that where, like, some of the guys that I was in the band with, they got regular jobs and they moved on, more or less. And I didn't want to start doing it with new people anymore. And it had sort of just petered out, honestly, at the same time that this other interest was coming on really strong. So I just pursued that and decided I was going to get really good at that. And that's how we find ourselves here.
Yeah, but then, I mean, you started all over again. It's not like you then dedicated yourself to working in the best kitchens in the world and you traveled the world with a stick and the little bandana on it,
yeah,
honing your craft. I mean, dude, you went back to school.
Yes, true. I did go back to school. However, I was very specific about the school that I went to. And one of the reasons I went to the FCI, French Culinary Institute, was they had the most prestigious but shortest program, because I was in my late 20s by this point, and it didn't seem like I started over because I'd always been working in these restaurants. And, you know, the restaurants got progressively better and I wanted to do better work and I wanted to be in better environments. So they kind of built on themselves. So it didn't feel like totally starting over, but going back to school for it, that was a bit of a big deal. That's when I fully committed. And I knew that if I went to the Culinary Institute of America, that was going to be like 2 years. And I felt like I had enough base experience. FCI's program was much shorter, but it was still very respectable. A lot of good people came out of there. Dave Chang, Wiley Dufresne, Bobby Flay, and others have came out of that school. So I felt like I could go for a shorter period of time, polish up my skills, and then get into the kind of kitchens that would allow me to jumpstart my career at a slightly older age than most people really start doing the tough line work and stuff coming in. Because most of the guys that come into my kitchen now, or most of the men and women that come in, they're in the early 20s usually. And I was already in my late 20s.
Did you have a muse? Was there a model you followed for your career where you were like, oh, that would be good? Or that guy seems like he made a lot of great choices.
There are people whose choices I admire and that I often had thought that I should follow, but never felt like the situation was workable for me. And some of it was because of my age, right? I didn't feel like I had the time to... I couldn't work in New York for $8 and live with six other guys in Queens.
Sure.
That wasn't going to happen. Or even when I came to Chicago, I staged at Trio when Grant Achatz was still the chef at Trio. And it was an experience that I really, really wanted. But by that time, I was 30, married, and could not work 16 hours a day, 5 days a week for barely any money.
Right.
And even when I spoke to Grant about it, when he offered me the job, he looked at me point blank and was like, you're a little old for this, aren't you? So I had to just try to find a different path to get to where I wanted to be and make the best of the opportunities that seemed like practical ones. I turned down a job at the Inn at Little Washington, which would have been fantastic. It was a beautiful, beautiful restaurant. And the food that they make is incredible. And the experience was incredible. But again, it's in the middle of nowhere, and the money wasn't great. It was way less than I had been making at my job before, and I was married, and I didn't know what my wife was going to do while I was off doing this job, and it just didn't seem like a practical way to go about things. So, but those are like the kinds of paths that I had seen that I wanted to emulate. Work in the absolute best kitchens, work at the highest level you possibly can, get all this experience, and then you can do your thing, right? And I had to pass on some of those opportunities, teach myself a lot more, and take risks on my own skill set. When a chef job was offered to me in Chicago, I had to just take it and make the most of it. And it worked out okay. But it wasn't the work for the best chefs you possibly can, build up your resume, work for a couple more kind of trajectory that I had maybe imagined coming out of culinary school. But it's the hand I was dealt at the time, and I tried to maximize it as best I could.
So you spent a fair amount of time at the Hyatt. In working in a corporate environment, I would assume that served you well to a certain degree, that you were provided with a blueprint and an infrastructure for what things potentially look like at scale. Or maybe it was a complete waste of your time. I have no idea. Was there any value in those experiences? Because it's so different from what you do today. But at the same time, it's a business and it's got to function in the way that a profitable business does. So were there lessons there?
There were definitely lessons there. I think some of the lessons that I learned there were more in effectively motivating and managing as a team, because the Park Hyatt in Chicago at the time that I worked there, Nomi was one of the best restaurants in the city for a number of years. And it was supposed to be like a flagship restaurant for the Park Hyatt brand in the U.S. We had a lot of leeway in terms of the food cost for the hotel because we had private events and all the banquet money. We had the bar and the lounge and the terrace. We had inner dining. We had all these other outlets that would contribute to the overall food and beverage revenue stream. And it meant that Nomi could be in some way subsidized by all of that other money where the margins are just way better. And we had the most beautiful, expensive china and copper pots and the best stoves and the best ingredients. And we could just like make really good food. And surprisingly, in one of the most corporate environments that I've worked in at that time, I had the least sort of corporate responsibilities to live up to. My labor cost was never an issue for me. My food cost was never an issue for me. The issue was making sure that the food is as good as it can be and the diner's experience is as good as it can be every night. And the rest of it was sort of taking care of itself or was being managed at least by the executive chef for the hotel and the executive sous chef for the hotel. And their marching orders to me were just make the food as beautiful and delicious as it can be. And that's your job. So I had to learn how to manage the team to accomplish that and do it in a very HR-friendly way, right? Because there's an HR department at the hotel. So it's not like independent restaurants where that is often not the case.
Sure.
So I think that's what I learned from that as much or more than anything else, which seems somewhat counterintuitive, right? You'd think it'd be the most structured of my experiences. And in some ways, it was less structured than I had anticipated it would be.
You've been an executive chef for a long time, like long enough that I would argue that the way you would define executive chef over the course of, let's say, the last two and a half decades, has changed and evolved over time. How have you evolved as an executive chef, and how has your definition of executive chef shifted over the years?
Maybe hasn't it shifted as much as it should. A friend of mine, when I was thinking about leaving the hotel and coming to work at Sepia, my time at the Park Hyatt was the only corporate restaurant job I ever had. Everything else was small independent restaurants and independent restaurants where there wasn't even two. We didn't even have two. We just had one. I was debating whether I should leave the hotel and come back to an independent restaurant, but that's kind of where I'm from. And this friend of mine who's a Chicago restaurateur and I'd worked for him, he said to me, look, buddy, I'd rather be a pirate than be in the Navy. And I understood what he meant. Like the independent restaurant is the pirate ship and the hotel is the Navy, obviously. I'd rather be a pirate too. But being a pirate and being the executive chef of the pirate ship sort of means that I am still here 12 hours a day. I still do prep work. I still work station occasionally if it comes up. I still wash dishes if I have to if it comes up. I fix the sink. There's a lot of things about being an executive chef that to me are more like business owner than executive chef. Everything is your problem. And I've certainly gotten better at delegating as I've gotten bigger staffs. Like I currently have a chef de cuisine at Proxy and a chef de cuisine at Sepia. They're both super talented. They're both very capable of doing this. Probably, we won't let them know this, but probably without me. And getting good at letting go of some of the stranglehold of control and allowing them to do the jobs I hired them for has been one of the things I've really tried to get better at. And that goes for like the sous chefs too. Trusting people to do the job you've hired them for, giving them the opportunity to do it, trying to be good about setting clear expectations of what that job looks like so that they know what they should be doing. And those are the things I've tried to improve on over the years, because there was a time when I was the executive chef of the restaurant. Yeah, but I was also a line cook every day, and I did all the ordering, and I did all of the butchery in the morning, and I would do so much of everything. And as my career has gone on, I've been able to let more and more of it go to the people that we hired to do those jobs. But I still feel like if I'm not actually physically contributing to making sure that I've made the sous chef's day easier by taking care of some of their butchery projects or doing some of the knife work for the Garmazé station. And it's also a way that I get to stay involved with everybody, because one of the things that I don't want to become is the kind of executive chef who's like in his office looking at an Excel spreadsheet all day, or spending too much time going over like, well, last week the bronzino was $9.95 a pound, and this week it's $12.10 a pound, and I'm going to waste a lot of time on that. When in reality, that's going to keep going up and down a little bit. Just keep an eye on it. As long as it doesn't get too out of whack, you're fine. Or change the price on the menu. I still feel it's very important for me to be involved day to day with the team in the kitchen and make sure that they see that I'm there, that I care about what we're doing, that I'm going to contribute to making their day as pleasant and as easy as I can. So I think I've gotten better at it, but that's my long-winded answer to your relatively simple question.
I would ask, sure, at year 5 with Sepia or year 10, but like as we approach year 15, at some point, and I think we've all felt this way in our restaurants, it very much becomes this Groundhog Day-esque scenario where...
Yeah, for sure.
You know what I mean? Where if you don't pull yourself out, if you don't figure out a way to make the job interesting, because, you know, we spend a lot of time talking with each other professionally about how to keep our staffs engaged. But like over the years, once we weren't worried about money anymore, right? Once we weren't worried about getting busy anymore and the shine of success had kind of worn dim, I was as worried about keeping myself engaged and keeping myself interested. So what has that been like for you with the success for so long? How do you keep yourself actively engaged?
Well, I mean, one of the ways I keep myself actively engaged is I'm still constantly involved in, well, what are the new dishes we're going to do? Coming up with them myself. And I mean, also trying the stuff that my chef de cuisines are making, but like I still contribute dishes to the menu all the time. So that's a level of engagement that hasn't gone away. And some of it is just simple problem solving. We need a new dish. And the reasons we need a new dish are not because I had some great inspiration, but because I have an ingredient's gone out of season, we're tired of this one, it doesn't seem to be working for whatever reason, whatever the cause is, there's a problem that needs to be solved. And so I find that still engaging. Another thing that happened was the pandemic kept it real engaging. And it's only, even at this point, I still feel the restaurants are suffering the after effects. It hasn't all gone away. It's not back to like what it was. Our business levels are still not quite the same. The way guests dine is not the same. There was a couple of years there where I was engaged because it was a street fight just to stay open and to stay a viable business. And I had that period leading up to the pandemic where like CP had been open for 10 years that I'd been the chef. So the first one was we opened Proxy, and that's a way of remaining engaged and excited. Now I'm doing a new project. And then after Proxy had been open for 3 years, pandemic. Okay, this is an engaging subject that I need to really focus on, because otherwise we're going to be closed. So that was sort of an unpleasant way to stay engaged. And then since then, it's been the struggle of trying to figure out how we're going to staff the restaurants. It's only recently gotten easier. There was a number of years there where it's real hard every day to, are the dishwashers going to show up? Do we have enough line cooks? Who's sick? How many people are out this week because they're sick? How many people are we allowed to have in the dining room? It feels like a long time ago, but when I think about it, like, well, it really wasn't that long ago. And that's kept me pretty engaged, honestly. But you're right. There is an absolute Groundhog Day element to it. And I guess, you know, that's supposed to be part of the beauty of it, right? Roger Verger, the famous 3-star Michelin French chef, his famous quote is, "We start every day with nothing on the stove. That is the essence of cuisine."
And you just think like, oh God, if you had to start every single day from scratch in this business, like how could you do that every day for like 50 years?
For sure. I so vividly remember standing in the scullery in a 3-piece suit, plowing through dishes and turning to the other dishwashers and saying, you know, if you sacrifice and you work hard every single day of your life, maybe one day you can stand in the scullery
in a 3-piece
of your
suit.
Own restaurant, right?
Yeah.
It's definitely part of the dynamic. And I think for us, it's great to work hard, but it's also great to feel like there's an ROI. And what I found in my own career is that there's just as much ROI in the restaurant as outside of the restaurant. But I didn't figure that out until I left the restaurant.
Oh, tell me what that's like.
Well, actually, I wanted to talk to you about it because I've seen you hold a spatula and I've seen you hold a ping pong paddle. And you're out and about in the festivals. And I will tell you this, I was not as well networked and as well traveled as I should have been as a restaurateur during the years I was most successful and most active. But once that happened, it completely transformed not only my view of the industry, but my view of my role in the industry. So for you, as someone that is active in community events and in festivals nationally and internationally, how has that informed your career?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, mostly, I don't know, I have these, all of the things that come to mind when you mention that are so boringly logistic. I go and I do these offsite events or festivals and things. And one of the reasons we do them is because it's a PR opportunity, right? We bring something that we make to the public and we say, here it is, please try it. Please come to our restaurant. We hope you enjoy it. And it has this secondary benefit of 90% of the time, at least, it's a charity that we're trying to help raise money for, which is a worthy cause in and of itself. My interactions with the people at those events tend to be relatively limited, I have to say. Here's the thing. I tell them what it is. They try it. Some of them engage. Some of them don't. I try to be as charming and pleasant as I can. But it's like the service industry writ large is like, some people really want to be engaged with. Some people really want you to just give them the thing and walk away. So probably the things that I've learned the most from doing those events is how to efficiently and effectively deliver the best product at those events, how to try to represent the restaurant as best I can through the food and through the just setting up the table nicely and being professional and ready to go and having the stuff and always bringing the best product that we can. I often see other restaurants bring what seem to me like varying degrees of effort to these things. Sometimes it's a little crostini with some roasted beets and goat cheese on it, and here you go. And I think that's really as good as you want to do for this. This is what you want to put forward. And that's fine. And they have whatever the reasons are for doing that. And their choices are not for me to judge. But that's just not good enough for us. And I might make them too difficult sometimes. I don't know. But it's always in an effort to try to present the best version of the restaurant that we can, because it's really about trying to convince people that they want to go, you know where we should eat? Because at Sepia or at Proxy, that thing that we had was really great. I mean, that's really from doing those kinds of things what I've taken away. And like the other nice thing is being able to talk to other people in the industry and the other chef friends I have. Particularly, there's a lot of events in Chicago every year, and there's a relatively short list of us that all do them. So we get to see each other. It's sort of like the chef opportunity to hang out, say a quick hello, catch up real quick. So that's nice because it does build community amongst the other chefs. But that's mostly what I get from doing those, I think. Once in a while, if it's out of town, if it's real far out of town or something, then I can have a really cool experience. Like I was offered the opportunity to do guest chef at the Park Hyatt in Tokyo. And that's just fantastic. But that's a very unique experience.
You have gray hair and a shit ton of Michelin stars. I think everybody listening knows how to get gray hair. Most probably already have it or are well on their way. How do you get a ton of Michelin stars? I mean, I think that for the people listening, there are these platitudes around excellence and this and that and consistency. And everybody knows that. But when you've done it and you've done it consistency over a period of time, I can't believe that there hasn't been some self-reflection. Because you sit alongside great restaurants that don't get the same accolades, right? And so that being the case, what have you determined differentiates you that helps you to stand out above the rest?
I really wish that I had a good answer for that, because my knee-jerk reaction, I don't think is actually fair to a lot of the other very, very good restaurants that have not gotten a Michelin star. At the end of the day, some of it, the business that we're in is incredibly subjective, right? I can make something and I can think it's delicious, but if the dining public doesn't think it's delicious, then is it in fact delicious, or is it just I think so? What a Michelin inspector really is looking for, really wants, I mean, I have as good an idea as anybody else does. I've tried to make sure that we consistently put out a solid product day in and day out. I know that statistically there have had to been dishes that went out that people did not like. I've heard about it. It happens. But on average, we're still very far ahead of the game on that, right? But I mean, because my knee-jerk reaction was going to be like, well, the simplest thing that I can say is you have to give a shit, right? The most important part about making good food consistently is you just have to care enough to do the tedious, irritating, grueling, unpleasant work of making all of these things every single day as good as they can be. And all of the variables, all of the details that go into every dish, it's just, it's crazy. If you look at a prep list and one dish has got 15 things that you have to have prepared for it, and then you know that you've got six dishes on your station and they're all basically that complicated, it's a lot of work. And you have to really care and have other people supporting you that also care to make sure that all those components are done properly so that the final dish is good. But I got to believe that there's at least a certain element of good luck and making your own good luck by working hard at it. And you also have to have a standard to which you want the restaurant to be. A lot of people open restaurants that have no intention of getting a Michelin star. It's not part of what the restaurant's supposed to be about. And if that's something you want, and Sepia was open to be a casual neighborhood bistro originally. Michelin wasn't even in the conversation because Michelin hadn't come to Chicago yet anyway. And when I took over after the first year that Sepia had been open, my style of cooking, particularly coming from Nomi, was just fancier. And I just spent a couple of years making really fancy food. And so that bled into the food I was doing at Sepia. And once we got the star that first year, we just tried to keep building on the things that we thought had gotten it there. That the quality of the food, the quality of the product, the quality of the execution, the consistent freshness, the changing things with the seasons, the like details and all of those things cumulatively got us there. So now we need to refocus on those and continue to push in that direction just to maintain it. And we've never really wanted to turn Sepia into a two-star restaurant because we can see from other two stars what that model looks like. It's not something that my business partner and I really want to do. That's not a goal. We want to be a really good, consistent one-star restaurant. That's our niche. We want to stay in it. Our success will not be getting two stars. Our success is paying our investors, and our success is maintaining this very good one-star thing. But I really wish that I had the secret to how do you get a Michelin star, because it seemed like just caring enough and working hard enough did it for us. But that's not to say that other people don't work really hard and care a lot and they don't get one. And I'm not sure why.
So I envision in the first couple of years you're at Sepia, you're like sauntering around the dining room or in the back of the house and you're thinking to yourself,
I don't saunter. There's no sauntering.
You're trudging through the front of the house and the back of the house and you're thinking,
walking with purpose.
Yes, right. Thinking to yourself, man, if I had opened this restaurant myself, I would have done this differently and that differently. And this thing over here pisses me off. And then you get your chance with Proxy, right? What did you do differently? What went well? When you look back, and I'm sure that there were tons of surprises along the way, because that's just the nature of this thing. But what did you do well? When you look back on the decisions you made in the opening of Proxy, what would you double down on today?
I've been very happy with the way I designed the kitchen for its functionality, for the kind of food that I thought we wanted to do. That was the original idea. And our kitchen, it's got kind of a less than ideal layout, but that's something that I had no control over. I was given the blueprint. Here's where the kitchen's going to go. do the best you can. And so that part I like. I think also I'm a real big believer in, if you can afford it, get the best equipment you can right out of the box. I've worked in restaurants where they bought not great equipment and it breaks very quickly. The rigors of a restaurant on equipment are real. And buying good stoves, buying good ovens, it's worth it, I think, in the long run. I also think that one thing is, don't be undercapitalized. How about that? Like, if you're going to open a restaurant,
I mean, have some money. If there was only one piece of advice,
there's only one piece of advice. Do not be undercapitalized, because we afforded ourselves the opportunity to do a couple of good friends and family nights to get our feet under us. We spent the money to have serious days and days of staff training. Oh, look, it's our friend Jonathan Sawyer. What's going on,
yes.
Jonathan? Hey, man, how's it going? Oh, nice. That's cool, man.
I appreciate it, Jeff.
Oh, cool.
And that's how small this world is.
Yeah, for sure. That is, man. That's hilarious.
That's hilarious. Yes.
So I guess John's up next, huh?
John's up next. Yep.
Yeah. Cool, man. So we really spent the time to train the staff. We really spent the time to go over the menu with them, to do the mock services, to do all the things to try to be sure that when we opened, we could open real strong. And I think that it seems obvious, but it's not easy. And it's an investment in the longevity of the restaurant, right? It's an investment in making sure that the experience is good right from the jump. And I'm of two minds on this thing, because on the one hand, I can understand the argument that people have of like, well, don't go into the restaurant. They just opened up. Give them a chance to get themselves together and give them a chance to work out some of the kinks. That's a very fair position. And as the business owner, I love that one. That sounds good. But I can also see a very reasonable argument from the patron side, which is, well, are you going to charge me full price? Well, then you better have your shit together, man. You better be ready to go. Because if my steak costs $40 today and you don't have your act together yet, and it's going to cost $40 in 6 weeks when you have your act together, why did I have to pay the same when you're not doing it right? So making sure that you have the money to invest in really being prepared to open, I think, was invaluable for us. Getting good equipment, really try to have the best, smartest workflow that you can, and making sure that the way that everything's set up and the menu makes sense together, which seems real obvious, but I don't know that it always happens, where people are like, well, we're going to make this food and here's what the kitchen is. And a lot of times that's because you're maybe taking over an existing, and maybe you're taking over a kitchen that's already there, and you try to shoehorn something into it that's not going to work. That could be a problem. I had the luxury of being able to build it from zero to be as good a version of a factory for my kind of product as I could get.
What should we steal from you? What tactics, tools, strategies, when you look at yourself and the success that you've experienced in the industry, what do you think is directly translatable to someone else?
I'd like to think that my patience, I'm a relatively patient man, which is not something that chefs are known for being. But there's a lot of times when I think that you need to be more patient than chefs are known for being, right? And it serves me well, because I have most of my kitchen staff have stayed with me for a pretty long time, historically. I've had sous chefs that have been with me for like 10 years, or my chef de cuisine at CP has been with us for 5 now, and the guy before him was with me for 12. And I think some of that is because I am a reasonable, patient person who understands that mistakes are going to be made. And as long as we learn from them and try not to replicate them and like move forward from them, I'm not patient with people who don't really seem to care or who are committed enough. You have to be committed. It's a team thing. Everybody's got to be on the team and committed to doing what we're doing. And if you're not really committed, my interest in you is going to be limited. But if you are committed, then I want to support you and be patient while you learn to be better, tell you what you need to do to help hopefully be better in the context of our restaurant. And I think that that ultimately works better than, at least for me, works better than what people usually associate with fine dining chefs, of just being tyrannical, egomaniacal pricks who want to grind you into submission so that they can then drop two microgreens on something and send it out to the table or whatever. That's just not the way I've done it. And I've seen a lot of people who do it that way who are more successful than me, who are known for being really difficult. And maybe sometimes that's the only way to get there, but I've chosen a different route that I think has worked okay for me.
Our industry suffers from razor-thin margins, and the only way for us to ensure profitability is to make data-driven decisions. The numbers don't lie, and Yelp for Restaurants just released some incredibly compelling numbers. For starters, Yelp reaches 9 times more customers online than OpenTable. And when restaurants pair that level of visibility with Guest Manager and Yelp ads, they experience up to an 8% lift in diner bookings. Think about what that 8% lift could do for your restaurant's finances. To learn more about how Yelp for Restaurants can support your business, visit restaurants.yelp.com/full comp to learn more today. That's Andrew Zimmerman. For more information on the chef and his restaurants, visit chefandrewzimmerman.com. If you want to tell us your story, hear previous episodes, or check out our other content, go to restaurants.yelp.com/full comp. Thank you so much for listening to the show. You can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. While you're there, please leave us a review. A special thanks to Yelp for helping us spread the word to the whole hospitality community. I'm Josh Koppel. You've been listening to Full Comp.